Excuse me. I'd like to remind all participants this conference is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. You may begin.
Thank you.
Hello to everyone, and welcome to the Recommendation 6 Community Working Group call. I would like to ask Lynn if she would identify who's on the call, please.
I will do that with pleasure for you, Chuck. We have on the call yourself, Chuck Gomes. Stuart Lawley, Avery Doria, who is from the GNSO, Frank Marsh from the GAC, Konstantinos Komatis from the Non-Commercial Consumers, Non-Commercial Stakeholder Group, Bacon de la Chapelle from the GAC, John Nevitt, Business Constituency, but I believe in an individual capacity, Caroline Greer from the Registry Stakeholder Group, Robin Gross from the Non-Commercial Stakeholder Group, Milton Mueller from the Non-Commercial Stakeholder Group, Richard Tindall, I believe in an individual capacity, Sebastian Bachelot from the ALAC, Krista Papik from the Registrar Stakeholder Group, Alan Greenberg from the ALAC, Evan Lebovich from the ALAC, Mary Wong from the NCSG, Paul Stahura in an individual capacity, Cheryl Langdonor, Chair of the ALAC, Andrei Koleshnikov, Nominating Committee appointee on the GNSO Council, and for staff we have Marika Koenig, Kurt Pritz, sorry, let me hit my page, Dan Halloran, and myself, Glenda Saint-Jacques. Have I left off anybody?
Thank you, Glenn. I didn't hear anyone that was missed. So,
this is Bertrand. When I look at the participant list on the Adobe Connect, there are other people that are listed in the attendee list, so I don't know if they are not on the call and are just on the Adobe Connect, but I see Carolyn Greer, Dave Kitsunduyal, Krista Papak, and other people, Tony Kirsch.
Both Krista and Caroline were mentioned, Bertrand.
Yes. Oh, sorry, my mistake then.
So I don't know about all of them, but certainly there's...
Tony Kirsch is not on the call yet.
Okay.
Joseph Frakes has just joined, and Tony Kirsch is now on the call.
Okay. Good, thanks.
Good up.
Appreciate that.
Good evening, everyone. Tony Kirsch here.
Okay, thank you. Okay, this is Chuck Gomes, and I'm co-chairing this meeting with Cheryl and with Frank in Heather's place. And so, Cheryl and Frank, please feel free to jump in at any time and keep me straight. The outline for our meeting today is to, first of all, go through the excerpts that are in Appendix A to the Terms of Reference, and they are excerpts from the Draft Applicant Guidebook Version 4, and just identify any areas of those excerpts that anyone has a concern about. We're not going to talk about why you have a concern first time through. Just identify where there are concerns. And then after we make that list, we will come back and talk about the concerns with the initial goal of trying to start getting people thinking in terms of, first of all, understanding the concerns so that we all have a mutual understanding. And then secondly, and I don't know how far we'll get on this today, but is to start thinking about possible ways that we might be able to recommend changes that might address the concerns in a way that most would support. Any questions on that approach? Now, is there anyone on the call that is not connected in the Adobe Connect room?
This is Evan. I'm rebooting and should be there shortly.
Okay.
This is Milton. I'm not on Adobe Connect, but I can get on as soon as I dig up the URL.
And in the meantime, if you want to comment, just speak up so that I can put you in a queue.
Okay.
Okay?
Thanks.
Thanks for letting me know, and hopefully you'll be able to get in. All right. Anyone else have anything to say before we start? All right. Looking at Appendix A in the terms of reference and in the guidebook, there are four grounds for objections. We're concerned with just the one area, and that's the morality and public order objection. And that's the one that you see there. The applied for GTLD string is contrary to generally accepted legal norms of morality and public order that are recognized under international principles of law. Keep in mind that our terms of reference don't deal with making any changes to Recommendation 6, but rather the implementation of it. So going then to Section 3123, Morality and Public Order Objection, note that it basically gives the standing for objecting, and that's very broad. Anybody may file an objection. Does anyone, and they're subject to a quick look procedure. We'll come back to that a little bit later. Any concerns about paragraph 3123?
Chuck, this is Evan. I'm not in Adobe yet.
Go ahead, Evan.
The one thing that just kept shouting out at me as we were going over this during the at-large summit was, what internationally recognized standards for this exist that this wording was referring to? We had a real problem just finding out even what this was talking about.
Well, Evan, I'm...
Chuck, it's Frank here. I was going to raise the issue, of course, of the definition in the paragraph above, that is, that recognized under international principles of law, which, of course, we have discussed, and recognize that there are no such principles of law. So even, I think that point is recognized, that there is no universally acceptable international definition of what that term means.
So what's the value of this preamble if it refers to nothing tangible?
Well, I'm not sure it's accurate to conclude that it refers to nothing. I'm sure all of you read the documents posted by the ICANN implementation team. I'm not an attorney, certainly not an expert in international law, but I'll invite Kurt or Dan to jump in if they would like. But as I went through those documents again, I don't think they claimed anywhere that there are any internationally adopted treaties that cover these things. But what I did note in going through them is that there are elements of national laws that appear to be common across the international arena. Now, Kurt or Dan, do you want to? Did I say that right? Is that an accurate interpretation? Kurt, Dan, are you both still on?
I'm here, Chuck. So is the question say the question again.
Sure. Let me break it down into a couple components, Kurt. And thanks for responding. The point has been made on previous exchanges in this group that there's no international law with regard to morality and public order. No international treaty that has that or anything like that. So, but when I read the proposed standards for criteria that the third-party panel would use, the principles that were adopted were based on common elements of national laws. They're common across the international arena. I think that's, to me, that seems like another way to fulfill the GNSO recommendation. Am I saying that right?
Well, I don't think you said anything wrong. I think. So like you pointed out at the beginning, we wrote a pretty, what we think is a fairly comprehensive paper on how these were developed. So, you know, I think your first focus on what are accepted legal norms. So you look at legal norms across different jurisdictions and look for those types of names that might be controversial in across essentially all jurisdictions. So we're not necessarily looking for international law. We're looking for legal norms across many jurisdictions. You know, legal norms are generally accepted.
Okay. I see several hands up. Let me let them jump in. Milton?
Yeah, hi. Thanks, Chuck. The problem with, as I read these descriptions of laws, is that they all, particularly the items having to do with incitement, this is referring to typically to behavior in a particular context which causes a crime. Of course, I'm most familiar with the incitement laws in the U.S., but, for example, inciting a riot, okay, there's no way that a TLD string can incite a riot. The mere existence of a TLD string cannot do that. What might do it in certain cases is certain kinds of behavior or content associated with a TLD, but it's very difficult to say that a TLD string by itself would be inciting anything. So that's one of the major problems with this whole approach.
Thank you, Milton. Constantino.
Yes, hello. I actually understood exactly the same way you did, Chuck. The fact that the ICANN staff went to various jurisdictions and actually tried to understand the experience of what's happening there. But even if that's the case, which mainly we're talking about a collage of various laws, we cannot possibly call them international principles of law. International principles of law under international law are only the ones that are derived by treaty or any other international law instrument. So it is a mistake to refer to five national laws that happen to be similar or the same as international principles of law, and I would like to bring that to attention of the group. Thank you.
Thank you, Constantino. Aubrey?
The only thing I'd like to add is that the definition is pretty much what you expressed, plus another piece that really says, trust the jurist, they'll recognize it when they see it. So I think that if this group comes to sort of accept that stands in instead of international law, then you have your definition. But basically you have addition that is, as Constantino said, the collage of national law plus jurists recognize it when they see it. Thank you.
Thanks, Aubrey. Bertrand.
I think it is important to make a distinction here. In international law, there is this notion of general principles of international law that can be used in a court at the international level or in an international dispute. And among those general principles of international law, the typical sources are indeed, on the one hand, treaties, international agreements, and things that have been ratified at the global level, or even declarations without an implementation procedure that have been sufficiently endorsed by a broad range of national governments. The second source is the fact that when a court at the international level wants to find a principle, they sometimes refer to the presence of this principle in a sufficiently broad range of national jurisdictions and legal systems. However, in most cases, those principles are positive principles. It can be, for instance, the principle of fairness. It can be the principle of freedom of expression. It can be a certain number of other positive principles. And sometimes a general prohibition, like prohibition of slavery, prohibition of child exploitation, or things like that. These are universally accepted, somehow, principles. But the distinction I want to make here is that these are not principles that are called morality and public order. Because as the GAC has raised, morality and public order is only used as exceptions in certain international agreements for taking national measures as an exception to the implementation of the general principle that is a positive one. And so here the problem we're facing is that there are general principles of law, but no general principles of morality and public order. And the problem we're facing is that there are two categories of objections that are likely to arise. Some that will be based on more or less universal principles, and this is typically the three first bullet points at the end in the list of possible grounds, and other objections that will not be made on the basis of an international principle, but on the basis of national sensitivities or national exceptions or national legislations. And I think it's very important from the onset that we make this clear distinction. There are no international principles of morality and public order. There are sometimes international principles of law, which are usually positive principles.
Thank you, Bertrand. Robin.
Thank you. I just wanted to raise a couple of points. One is to pick up on the concept that Milton was talking about with respect to the legal notion of incitement and how these recommendations are saying there can be no incitement of lawless activity, and there's agreement across the board that there can be no incitement for lawless activity. But the problem is what is considered lawless is entirely up for grabs, is entirely different from jurisdiction to jurisdiction, country to country. So it's not so simple to say, well, we all agree you can't incite lawless activity because, you know, what is perfectly legal in one country, a protected right, for example, abortion in the United States, it would be considered inciting lawless activity in other countries. So, you know, it's not good enough. It doesn't solve any problems to say, well, you can't incite lawless activity. Okay, done. Let's go on to the next issue. Because it needs to be defined and can't be defined. It's entirely up for grabs and different from jurisdiction to jurisdiction. And the other point that I wanted to raise was on this issue of, I'm concerned that what we're hearing is, well, there doesn't seem to be any kind of morality and public order standard, so what we're going to do is we're just going to take all the national laws and create a hodgepodge of those, and we'll use those instead. But that's not what the GNSO recommended. The GNSO did not say, we want ICANN to enforce all the world's national laws. That's not what this is about. So I'm not at all comfortable with sort of trying to take this in that direction, that this is just going to be a catch-all. Any law you can come up with, we'll come up with a policy in the GNSO new GTLD policy to go along with it. So I just wanted to raise those two points. Thanks.
Thank you, Robin. Andre. Andre, are you still with us? Andre Kolesnikov. Okay, we'll come back to Andre if he's still there. John Nevitt.
Yeah, thanks, John. I just wanted to offer maybe something that will give some comfort to the folks who are trying to parse through the GNSO objection. And I think we really need to focus on the term generally accepted legal norms of morality and public order versus international principles of law. If you read the exact recommendation from the GNSO, it says that the string must not be contrary to generally accepted legal norms of morality and public order, and that would entail taking into account the panoply of national laws, which, and of course, international principles of law will recognize national laws. So instead of looking for a silver bullet in a treaty or something, we should just look at the what's out there as generally accepted legal norms related to these areas. And if you're looking at, if you're talking about incitement to violence, for example, there are clear examples that you could come up with, and hopefully we don't have to discuss them. But I think Milton and others, there are clear examples of something that could be listed in a string that would incite violence just based on the name itself. And we should take that into account. Certainly, the GNSO recommendation was targeted at those kinds of strings. Thank you.
Thank you, John. Yep. So, Cheryl, did you want to jump in?
No, Chuck, this is Amy Stathis.
Oh, Amy. Yeah, thank you, Amy. Go ahead.
Sure. Sorry to jump out of queue. I just thought that John's comment was a good segue to what I was going to suggest. I think there's been some really good comments and some, and understanding and possibly misunderstanding in terms of what was done in the research paper and how staff got to the point where it did. What I might suggest, I think that, John made some good comments, Bertrand made some good comments. What I would suggest and see if I can try to set up is have our outside international expert who helped work with us on the research paper possibly at least present the approach that we took, maybe if we can do that at the next call.
Is there anyone that would object to that?
Amy, who is the international law expert, Amy?
That's Carol Dorgan, who is works out of Jones Day's Paris office.
Okay.
I think that would be a very, very good idea, Amy. I appreciate that suggestion. Cheryl and Frank, are you okay with that suggestion as co-chairs?
Absolutely fine by me. Thanks, Chuck.
Yeah, and at least it's just a way, Chuck, to get you guys understanding how the approach that we took.
Yeah. Thank you, Amy. Cheryl, are you okay with that?
Yes, Chuck, but on the other side of the room, if you read the chat on the green.
No, I don't even try. but I can look right now. I'm not seeing very much showing on my screen. Oh, down below. Okay. Here we go. Your point, Cheryl, is what?
Having come back to the other side of the room now and not being able to see the room, yes, Chuck, I'm agreeing with you, and it fits what you outlined, which was for us to go through and identify the particular sectors out of this Appendix A that merit return, and this is, one of the primary points that the at-large and AULAC statements have made from the very beginning, that this is a discussion that, one of the discussions that we certainly need to have, and I think Amy's suggestion of having a completely dedicated call to the topic and a great deal of on-list activity as well is essential. So long version, yes. Let's do
thanks.
It.
Okay, thanks. I appreciate that. All right.
Now
Kevin.
I'll go back to the room again.
Kevin, you're next.
Hi, Chuck. I guess I just wanted to go back to the original plan that you had, having started part of this mess. I thought the intention right now was just to identify things right now rather than discuss them out.
That is correct. And I was planning to get us back on target here. Quite a few people jumped in, so...
Yeah, it wasn't my intention to start drilling down right now. You wanted to identify some things, and that looked to be as core as anything in terms of what we need to go through, but not right now.
Yeah, and I probably was guilty in causing that myself by my response. Very quickly, let's go to Bertrand and then Milton, and then we'll go back to making our list. Bertrand? Bertrand?
Yeah, do you hear me?
Yes, I do now.
Yeah. Two points. Regarding the example, we are really talking in the document about violence lawless action. It's not only lawless action. So the argument that it can be lawless in one country and not
according to the law in others, is not relevant here. We're talking about the expression violent lawless action. We'll come to that later. I've seen in the chat that Milton has mentioned the example of kill the Jews. I wanted to use a dot kill Hindus or dot kill Muslims or whatever. I'm sorry. In as much as we can defend free speech in whatever way, I do not see that this could not be contrary to international norms. And this is clearly inciting to violent, lawless action. So in this case, it's a topical example. The second point is regarding Robin's comment regarding a hodgepodge of national laws. I want to make something very, very clear here that she's absolutely right. The purpose is not to introduce the obligatory respect of every single national law by a TLD string. And I don't want to speak on behalf of the GAC here, but as far as I'm concerned and position for France, the system that we want to put in place does not amount and should not amount to giving basically or requesting from the GAC a veto right to a string given to any single government. This is clearly not the purpose. What we're trying to handle is, on the one hand, the cases where the string is clearly universally objectionable, whatever the criteria are, and we can discuss that. And on the second hand, how to handle strings, and this will come to the universal resolvability issue, how to handle strings that are illegal for whatever reason in one country, but could nonetheless be considered acceptable at the global level or not. So it is not about forcing every single national law on the common international global route. I don't speak on behalf of the whole GAC, but I don't think that the whole GAC would consider that this is the position they're starting from. I think it's very important to make that clear from the onset.
Thank you, Bertrand. And I'm going to very quickly call on Milton and then Andre again, and then let's go back to making our list and save the discussion for a little bit later in the call. Milton.
Yeah, I want to find out better when you talk about making the list what exactly you're talking about. Maybe I won't need to intervene here, but you're going through, as I understand it, the proposal by the staff for implementation and asking if people have any problems with it. Is that correct?
Yeah, identifying particular elements where they might have a problem, yes.
Okay. So let me just say that I'm really confused now about the position of the GAC when they are identifying the problems that they have, and maybe this can be clarified. So I heard Frank say very clearly that there is no internationally agreed standard of morality and public order, and now I've heard Bertrand say that there are internationally agreed norms, and I don't find myself understanding the distinction. If the GAC believes that there are internationally applicable norms of morality and public order, then why did they object to this procedure?
Ed, let's come back to that. It's a very valid question. Let's get back to our list. But before I do that, let me give Andre a chance to get in the queue here.
Thank you, Chuck. Somehow I was disconnected. Exactly at the minute I have to speak. So it didn't define the issues and somehow related to the previous Vertron words. So if there is no international norms nor laws, why don't we move to the next step and define appropriate skill levels and probably status, which can be internationally accepted, for example, as universal experts who can object to the TLD string. I see that those experts are much closer to the governmental environment, governmental level, rather than to the panel of the international experts, because most of us at this conference call are the international experts, not the governments. What's this noise?
I don't know. If you're not talking, you might want to put your phone on mute in case the interference is coming from your phone. Go ahead and finish, Andre.
Yeah, I see that those experts, which I've referred to, are much closer to the governmental level, governmental environment, rather than to the panel of international experts. Because most of us at this call are international experts. We're not representing the government and all the desires of the local government. So maybe this issue should be addressed somehow to the governmental institutions, not to the GNSO community in general. Thank you.
Thank you, Andre. John, did you still have your hand up? John Nevitt?
I'm sorry. I need to take it in.
Thanks. Okay. Now, let's proceed, and very quickly, just let people identify if there's an issue. You don't need to explain why you have an issue at this point, defend it or argue against it or whatever. But let's go to section 3123, and hopefully you have that in front of you so I don't need to read it for everyone. Are there any elements of that paragraph that anyone has a concern with? Just raise your hand if you do, and I'll call on you. So, at least for right now, I'm assuming that that paragraph is okay.
I'm sorry, Chuck, I can't. When you say 3123, are you talking about Roman numerals in this, or are you talking about a document that I don't have?
Yeah, the terms are, there's a couple ways you can get to it. You can go to Mod 3 of the new GTLD recommendations, Section 3123, or in the Appendix A of the terms of reference. Those excerpts are put into Appendix A so that they're easy to find.
Well, let's not assume nobody objects until we can actually find them. You might want to move on, though, until we look them up.
Okay.
It should be on your Adobe screen if you scroll down about halfway into the document.
Hey, in the meantime, Aubrey?
Yeah, thanks. I guess an issue with manifestly unfounded.
Okay.
And I did read, you know, the sections, and I understand, you know, the Potter Stewart clause that says the venerable ones will recognize it when they see it. But still, the notion of manifestly unfounded is sort of troubling to me, because to some of us, none of it is well founded. And to some people, everything will be well-founded. So I have trouble with that as a phrase.
Thank you, Aubrey. Anyone else have anything on paragraph 3123?
Chuck, it's Mary. I do. And one point was the point Aubrey just raised. And the other one is something I don't want to get into now, but because the quick look procedure document is so interwoven with the specific grounds, that really is the other reason for my concern, and I can explain that later.
Okay, thank you, Mary. Got that. And then we have, Aubrey, is your hand still up? I guess not. So anything else on paragraph 3123?
Chuck, this is Bertrand. Just a very quick comment that goes all through the text. One of the problems we have is the use and how we use the notion or the expression morality and public order. So, of course, everywhere we use this very expression, there might be concerns. In the case of GAC submission, there is this notion of sensitivities. In a more general term, there could be a replacement expression of public interest objections or so. But apart from that, it's a more general cautionary note regarding the term morality and public order, which in many respects is not the right expression for the reasons we've already mentioned.
Thank you, Bertrand. I don't see any other hands. Anyone else on 3123? Okay, then 313 has a couple excerpts there that are pretty straightforward, I think, more process procedure oriented. and the selection of the dispute resolution provider. Anyone have any concerns about that section?
Sorry, what point Elsa. Again?
Excuse me?
Yeah, just very quick. I've always had a problem with the selection of the International Chamber of Commerce as the arbitrator of free expression rights. I'm wondering how this selection was made. I don't understand the connection between the ICC and morality and public order. Nothing against the ICC, but it's a business organization. It has no particular expertise in either freedom of expression or morality and public order. So I'm just wondering how that's justified.
Okay, and we'll come back to the question later. Constantino.
Yes, basically I just want to say that I'm sharing exactly the same concern for reasons that I can explain later.
Okay. Thank you. Mary.
Hi, my concern is similar but not entirely the same. To the extent that we're using the International Center of Expertise of the ICC, what I wanted to ask, and I don't know if it's within the brief of this group, is that because there's some DRSPs that provided some detail as to who the panelists might be and what the selection processes might be, I think it would be helpful if the ICC could indicate if they were going to do that, and if so, when.
Okay. And not seeing any other hands, anyone else have anything in section 313? All right.
Chuck?
Yeah. Yes, that's wrong.
Just to reiterate something that is always made as a confusion, it is not the International Chamber of Commerce. It's the Arbitration Center, which is a separate structure inside, which is not purely commercial and which I think is being used in a very broad sense for various arbitration disputes. So it needs to be explored further because I think most people misunderstand the distinction.
Okay, thank you. Let's go on to section 315. Now, it has to do with the independent objector. And of course, that in itself is a fairly involved process that has a lot of elements. And our focus isn't so much in this group on the independent objector process itself, but as it relates to recommendation 6 and the implementation of that. And let's take that particular section 315. There are two paragraphs, one fairly long. See if anyone has any concerns in that area. Bertrand, is your hand still up?
No, sorry.
Okay, Robin.
Yeah, thanks. I'm concerned about this concept of an independent objector who's going to, I mean, it sounds like some kind of morality czar to me, who's charged with defending the morality in the DNS. And, you know, it seems to me that if nobody has objected, if no governments have objected, no one has objected, you know, the idea that we need some special independent morality czar to raise the objection for us, I think, is a bit over the top. So I object to the concept of an independent objector bringing these kinds of objections.
Thank you, Robin. And please refrain from defending your concern at this point in time. We'll come back to that. Andre?
Yes, I completely agree. I don't like this idea at all. It's a moral czar. It will not be accepted by most of the community, and also it will most likely will not be accepted by many governments. Thank you.
Okay. Mary?
Similar concerns.
Thank you, Mary. And Aubrey?
Yeah, just a quick question. Would the independent objector's objection be able to be deemed manifestly unfounded?
It's a good question. Thanks, Aubrey. it really is. I'm laughing, but it is a very good question. So please don't interpret my laughing as minimizing your question, because I think it's a very good question.
Chuck?
Yes.
It's Marilyn. I just both wanted to announce I'm here and tell you I can't raise my hand because I'm on a phone, but may I make a comment now?
Yes, Marilyn, go ahead, and then you'll just need to let me know when you want in if you're not in
there.
Don't connect.
Sure. I'd like to
agree in concept with the concerns that have been raised by Robin and Andre and by Aubrey, I guess, as well. I do think it's very difficult to identify a morality czar. So the idea that we can find an independent objector who is just sort of floating out there and determines the need to act on the in the best interest of the public raises all sorts of questions of which part of the public, et cetera.
Thank you, Marilyn. Appreciate that. Anyone else on Section 315 and the independent objector idea? Okay. There's a one-sentence paragraph just before Section 343 in the appendix of the terms of reference that just basically says, for a morality and public order objection, the applicable dispute resolution service provider rules are the rules for the expertise of the International Chamber of Commerce. So, of course, that obviously comes back to the concern about that Milton raised about the ICC, Milton and Constantino, I think. I don't think we need to spend any time on that. It will relate, obviously, to the selection of the provider in that case, which is already identified. Evan?
Chuck, I just wanted to, I don't know if it's dangerous at this point to broaden it. At large had a generic problem with what we called the outsourcing of making this kind of judgment, that it didn't really let ICANN off the hook to simply outsource doing something that shouldn't be done in the first place. So whether it's done by ICC or any third party, we had a problem with what we saw to be outsourcing of moral judgment, just in general.
And Evan, that was the ALAC in general that had a problem there?
That was part of the at-large statement that came out of the summit and was a formal comment to DAG, too, I think.
Got it. Okay, thanks. I just wanted to clarify that so I could note it. Thanks a lot. Okay. Going on to 343, and here's where we, this has been referenced already by Bertrand, at least. The 343 is a critical part of the criteria as proposed in Applicant Guidebook Version 4. And as Bertrand mentioned before, there are three elements that start with the word incitement and are common at least across the jurisdictions that the ICANN staff and the experts looked at from different countries of the world. And then there's a fourth one that's a little more broadly stated. Let me just open it up, and I see hands already. Aubrey.
Okay, yeah, thanks. Mine is actually contrary to perhaps positions I've taken elsewhere, and I have trouble with the incitement to or promotion of discrimination based upon race, color, gender, ethnicity, religion, or national origin, in that I wonder why a narrower interpretation was taken of who shouldn't be discriminated against. For example, the French including disability and sexual preference, and then there are other groups. So while in general principle might have problems with the whole set of rules, if there are such incitement rules for discrimination, I think the list is too narrow. Thank you.
Okay. One second. I want to write myself a little note here. Okay. And then we have Mary.
Thanks, Chuck. I have, for the moment, two concerns with this paragraph. One is a language issue, because if you look at where it is here in DAC, it says general principles of international law for morality and public order as reflected in the agreements. Bertrand's already alluded to this, but that's a different formulation from Rec 6, which talks about, you know, legal norms. And without getting too technical or too much into international law, this is part of the terminology that as we get on with our discussions, we really, really need to agree on and clean up. The second concern I have is really with the three grounds, because the way I read the explanatory memoranda, there were experts consulted that did not recommend there to be specific grounds. So I am just wondering if this is something we should look at. I think we should, because it seems that there wasn't an adequate explanation as to why those specific three grounds as opposed to what other experts recommended to be included. Thanks.
Okay. Thank you, Mary. And anyone else on this area? Now, by the way, and I mentioned this early on, but I should remind people, you're welcome to raise not only issues with the text that's here, but also if you think something is missing, you can point that out as we're doing this as well. Anything else on 343? Okay. Going then to, then we just have the new GTLD recommendation, Principle G, which was added as there. The string evaluation process must not infringe the applicant's freedom of expression rights that are protected under internationally recognized principles of law. I think we're all familiar with that. What I'd like you to, okay, Bertrand. Your turn, Bertrand. Bertrand, are you on mute?
Do you hear me?
And now I do.
Yeah, well, there seems to be a problem. I was not on mute. Anyway, I wanted to just highlight the fact that this sentence is a good illustration of a proper use of the expression internationally recognized principles of law.
Wait,
because freedom of expression rights...
Tell us which sentence, please. Which sentence are you referring?
Principle G.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
And so freedom of expression is clearly an internationally recognized principle of law. So this is okay. But morality and public order concerns are not internationally recognized principles of law. That's the typical distinction that I wanted to highlight in the beginning.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Sounds like we have an echo now. So, okay. Anything else on that? Now, then I'd like you next just to look at the flowchart that's in Appendix B. If you're not familiar with the process, the way it is outlined, now, essentially it's probably covered by our previous discussion, but I did want to give opportunity in case anyone would like to... talk about the flow of the process in any way. Do you have any concerns there, any questions there? This is the process as proposed in version 4 of the guidebook. Okay. Evan.
I just want to note that the whole possibility of a role of the independent objector is not, I believe, in part of this flowchart, but is in another part of it. This is the specific part, I guess, that had the MAPO-based objection. The possibility of a sensibility, shall we say, based objection coming from the independent objector is far further down the process, if I recall.
Yeah, okay. Thanks for calling attention to that. Anyone else? Okay. Then let's go back then. And we'll proceed sequentially through these. Now, my suggestion, and I'm open to discussion on this, my suggestion is with regard to international principles of law and the issue that Evan raised right at the beginning is that we defer discussion on that to next week, when we have the expert on. Does anyone have a problem with that? Please speak up if you do. Okay. And I see, Bertrand, you have your hand up.
Yes, I do. I just wanted to make one comment regarding the flowchart, because the flowchart is dealing with the process of the objection itself. There's one element we haven't discussed that would be probably important is whether the positioning of the objection for those issues in the general workflow is appropriate. And in particular, if there is a real concern regarding a string, I just want to insert in the discussion here that it would be probably best to have this addressed as early in the process as possible, instead of launching a whole range of discussions with the applicants that would end up with the string itself not being accepted. So I just wanted to flag this at that level. We might have to address when, in the whole process, objections regarding the string on that basis would be handled. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. Now, not hearing any concerns with deferring the overall topic of international principles of law and the different ways of expressing that have come up several times in the discussion, we'll defer that to our next meeting. But let's go to the items that I've listed here, and starting with 3123, and this one actually covers several of the items because the term is used over and over again, and it's in the GAC letter to the board as well. And that's the use of the term morality and public order that Bertrand raised when we were talking about 3123. And let's spend a little bit of time talking about that. Bertrand, I think, gave some rationale for that before. He can add more as well as others that would like to. But in particular, does anyone see we've heard the concerns about the use of those terms. Is there a way to fix that in the guidebook? Anthony.
Hi, Chuck. I would just like to ask a question that may be interesting. We are talking about the string itself, correct? Not any content within the string or content in the second-level domain that might be inferred from the string. It's just the string itself. Is that correct?
Yes, I think that is correct. But please, Kurt, Amy, Dan, correct me if I misstate anything. So I think that is correct, Anthony.
Okay, so that's just an important point. I mean, I think we should be careful about looking at a string and thinking, oh, well, that's likely to have this or that sort of content. And I think we should just make sure that the string itself is what may or may not be objectionable. So that's my comment. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. Does anybody, I mean, and I think, do we have anybody besides Frank and Bertrand from the GAC on the call? And any of you are welcome. Do either of you see a possible way that of changing the implementation process and the use of the term morality and public order that might at least partially satisfy some of the GAC's concern, or is that not the way to approach it? Any thoughts on that?
Chuck, I've been trying to put my hand up. I'm not quite sure how I put my hand up in Adobe. I was going to address exactly that point. It's Frank here.
Go ahead, Frank.
The issue has come out of where the problem with the phrase is not the phrase itself, but it's a purported origination. That is that it comes out of some form of international law. I think that's a definitional issue. I think if we were to find a mutually agreeable definition of morality and public order that didn't rely on international law, then the problem would disappear. In other words, it's where the phrases come from rather than the phrase itself that I think raises the problem.
Thank you.
If that makes any sense.
Yeah, I'm just writing that down just a second. Okay, Mary.
I just had a question at the risk of going down historical roads that nobody else wants to. I was wondering if those of you who were involved in the process prior to the GNSO's final report can just a brief summary as to where the phrase morality and public order came from, says in Rec 6 and so forth.
Yeah, and I'm having been involved in that process, but it's been a long time. I have to be careful. Maybe somebody else can help me out, but the terms morality and public order did come out of some of the international documents that the GNSO PD
right.
working group
I should clarify, Chuck, and I guess, the phrase does come from those agreements, some of which have been referenced in the various documents. I guess my question probably more properly asked is whether that particular phrase, morality and public order, was actually dissected in some of the discussions, because, for example, morality and public order are not exactly the same thing, or was it simply taken as a phrase and then recommendations worked out after that?
I don't recall, and there are several people on this call that were also involved, us really dissecting those terms. Anybody correct me on that? I don't think we did.
And the reason I'm asking, too, is that since we're going back and looking at it, then it might be something that we discuss. And this goes back to Frank's comment as to whether or not there would be any sort of common definition. I sense that there would not be, but maybe we could look at either replacing it, perhaps along the lines of what Bertrand has suggested, or some other course of action.
And I really encourage everyone to think about possible replacements that might alleviate a little bit of the concern in that regard. I appreciate Frank's comment, though, that it's not so much the terms, although a common definition is needed, as he said, but it's the connecting the concepts of morality and public order to international law. So that point was well taken. Anthony, is your hand still up intentionally?
No, it's not, Chuck. Pardon me.
Thanks. Okay. By the way, Frank, did you figure out how to raise your hand? If you look at that mic.
Yes, Chuck,
okay.
Thank you very much. I did.
Okay, good. I thought I should have said something earlier. I'm sorry. So, okay, very good. Any other so be thinking about ways that maybe we can better, maybe use other terminology in certain places in this that might help a little bit. We don't have to come up with those right now, but I think that would be helpful if people are thinking in that direction. The next thing in my notes had to do with the quick look procedure Mary brought up. Mary, you want to talk a little bit about that?
About the quick look procedure?
Yeah, you had some concerns with it, right?
Right. And I have like about 12 windows open.
Okay.
I think the first thing was what Avery said, this question of what manifestly unfounded means. Is there a standard for it? And I don't know if anybody else has comments about that. Maybe that's something we should deal with first, because I don't think Avery and I are the only ones to have concerns about the standards.
Okay. Now, I'm a little bit hesitant to put staff on the spot, but we specifically invited some of the implementation team, including legal staff, to join us if they could, so that maybe we could hear their position with regard to how they came up with the terms, or maybe add some clarity there. Anybody from staff want to comment on that? What does manifestly unfounded mean? Is that a term that can be defined somewhat objectively, or is it a subjective judgment call on the part of the experts that are doing the evaluation?
Chuck, this is Amy.
Thanks, Amy.
So, I haven't really thought about defining it. I mean, yes, the goal of the quick look was to weed out those types of claims that would be frivolous. That was the goal of a quick look based on public comment coming out of the process. Manifestly unfounded was something that was meant, I believe, to focus on that, to weed out frivolous claims, if you will. I don't know at this point whether there can be more definition put to those terms, but I'm certain anybody's willing to consider if there's a more definite standard to put on those, we could certainly consider that.
Aubrey, you have any thoughts there?
Unmute. Not at the moment. I mean, I'm thinking about it, but basically, it all comes back to the subjectivity problem, where you're basically relying on some subjective jurist or as I say, wise man or woman somewhere be the one to make a subjective determination, and that. Where I see everything that we've got in this boiling down to, and I'm just concerned about that. So I think that those manifestly unfounded is really a ambiguous, and it's so ambiguous that it really doesn't say much, but it opens a big old door. Thanks.
Well, what if those two words were eliminated, and it just said an objective found to be an abuse of the right to object may be dismissed at any time. Is that any better, or still the same problem? And while you're thinking, Mary, go ahead.
I apologize if some of this is slightly scattered. I guess one thought I had was, you know, and the quick look procedure itself, I understood from reading it that certain things still need to be ironed out because there's the use of the word could and so forth. And one question there was find nature of such a thing, particularly given that it's the panel itself that's recommended as making that determination. And then that raises questions of appeal and so forth. That's one thing. The other thing is, with regard to if it is going to be the panel itself that makes that determination, and I'm not sure everybody's on board with that, one option might be to say, instead of saying it is or is not manifestly unfounded, simply to say that the panel considers the complaint to be the bounds of its authority to be within what the dispute resolution process is designed to deal with. Whatever the words are that we come out at the end, it seems to me that maybe practically speaking it'll lead us to the same place, but it seems to start off from a less negative boundary-driven determination.
Thank you, Maria. And I appreciate the thinking going on to see how it can be better worded. I'm sure staff does as well. Milton.
It sounds like we're having a substantive discussion of the manifestly unfounded issue, so I'm going to weigh in on that. I just want to express support for the idea that we need to recognize that there will be frivolous objections and that there have to be some written in procedures to filter those out. I think it would be extremely naive and irresponsible that if you create in a competitive business environment and also an environment that is rife with people abusing regulatory processes to shut up people who are their critics or who they don't like, that we have to recognize that there's going to be frivolous and manifestly unfounded objections. So that's good. I think the objection to this wording is coming from the fact that there seems to be a vacuum in terms of how we determine that. So I like what Chuck suggested, that if it is determined that the purpose of the objection is to create, simply to harass an applicant or to censor them in violation of their free speech rights or something like that, that there would be grounds for just tossing it out. However, that creates a whole other layer of bureaucracy. But in general, I'm happy with the fact that this was recognized.
Thank you, Milton. I see Aubrey in agreement with that statement. Any other suggestions on that? I mean, a good discussion, by the way. I think this is constructive discussion. That if I was staff, I would be very helpful for that, and I think I'm sure they are. Any other comments on this area? Okay. Let's go on then to the next thing I identified here, raised by Milton and Constantino and Mary, the use of the International Center of Expertise of the International Chamber of Commerce, and then Bertrand also weighed in on that. Let's talk about that a little bit. Milton already, expressed his concern that this is a commercial organization. Bertrand expressed that maybe not so commercial as it appears, but let's talk about that. Who would like to be on the queue there? Staff want to comment at all on terms of why this group was selected? Anything like that might be helpful, too.
Again, I wasn't going to get involved in the issue of whether or not any particular dispute service provider was a good idea, but whether or not the entire concept of farming it out was a good idea. When we had our discussions with N at Large on this in depth, we basically came to the belief that this was simply ICANN trying to pass the buck and toss this off to some third party as a way of absolving itself of the responsibility of actually making more, relative moral judgments that, this moral claim that this TLD goes in is more worthy than that objection that it doesn't go in. That this entire idea of having to make moral comparisons was not alleviated simply by farming it off to a third party. So I just want to toss in my two cents that rather than the issue of, is the ICC any better than, getting a panel of ethics professors or whatever, that the entire concept of tossing this off to a third party, because ICANN doesn't want to dirty its hands with what's really a very messy issue, is a problem unto itself.
Thanks, Evan. I have a question for you. Is your position on that, does it only apply to this because it's quote-unquote a moral issue? And the reason I'm asking that is because the objection process is referred to independent third parties for all four types of objection, not just morality and public order.
Understood, but this particular one gets into the field of, having to have someone dispute whether or not your sensitivities are more important than my sensitivities. And, we just came to the general conclusion that putting ICANN in a position where it or a group that it had to subcontract to made such a decision was going to be problematic in and of itself.
Now, usually I'm going to avoid inserting my own personal comments, but in this case, if you'll forgive me, I'll do it. If I was a board member, I would a lot rather have some expert jurists evaluate something like this in an area where they had an experience. But it still comes down to me. Before something gets in the root, the board is still involved. But that's just my own personal opinion, and I respect the fact that we can disagree on that. Let's go to Bertrand.
Do you hear me?
I do now.
Yeah, okay. Just one point. Unless I'm mistaken, I've not seen in the DAG or in the discussions an indication or a clear indication, and I may be mistaken, but a clear indication on whether the recommendation of such a panel, wherever it is binding or not on the board. The reason why I ask this is we have to remember that actually the board has to make a positive decision to accept a TLD in the root. And so we have not sorted out, as far as I know, whether if, for instance, whatever panel says this is contrary to international norms
or we consider that it is not appropriate, the board could say, yes, we do consider that it should nonetheless get in, or on the contrary, if the panel says we don't see a specific problem, then the board says, well, actually, we still do for whatever reason. So the question of whether the panel recommendations are binding or not, second, is important. The second thing is, we clearly have a discussion that was going on the chat on the notion of supermajority or not for the board, for instance, either to overcome the decision or the recommendation of the panel, or to, on the contrary, overcome the objections that would be expressed by other actors. Maybe this notion of a supermajority is something that could be worth exploring, and I tend to agree with Milton, in as much as we can envisage useful input from a panel of experts on those issues, particularly to have a clear understanding of what the legal norms at the international or national levels are, ultimately it remains a decision that the board has to make. So it's important to keep that in mind, I suppose.
Bertrand, for the sake of any who, like me, because I'm leading the meeting, it's difficult for me to keep up on the chat, but for others who may not have seen the discussion on the chat, could you explain a little bit what you're talking about with the supermajority and how that would come into play and what we're talking about? Please.
Well, actually, if I understood correctly, the notion was raised, I think, by Milton and taken up by somebody else, of this notion that in certain cases related to those, let's say, sensitive strings, maybe the board should take a decision to put a string in the root with a supermajority, either to endorse a string in spite of objections, or to overrule the recommendations of the panel or the objections. And so this notion that there are cases when the board may have to show that there is a clear large majority to support, for instance, entering a string in the root, even if it raises some local, even national concerns, is something that could be explored. And I could come back later to try to clarify the type of cases where this could apply. But I think it's worth maybe exploring a little bit more.
Thank you. And I, again, appreciate the people thinking of possible solutions. But I do want to ask one question for clarity there. So could the concept be that it would require a two-thirds vote of the board to overrule a decision by the expert panel either way? In other words, maybe they approve the string and the board goes against that recommendation, or the board they deny a string and the board could approve it. Does that fit in what you're thinking about? Or others that are thinking about that? Anyway, I'll just leave that there. I don't want to monopolize the time there. Let's go to Anthony.
Hi, Chuck. Thank you very much. I just wanted to, correct, but certainly not my understanding, something that Bertrand said. While I like the idea of the supermajority, and I believe that it is ultimately the board's responsibility to decide on this sort of thing where there's a big problem. I'd also like to note that it is not up to the board to accept a new TLD. That is something that the ICANN community did by putting together the new GTLD program, and it is up to the board to agree to that program, and once that program is in place, assuming that it looks somewhat like it does now, then what we have are a series of evaluations, and absent any problem, of which we're discussing one, that application will go ahead and will be put into the root. So I don't want us to think that
what we're doing is putting together a process where the board is going to pick and choose between the different TLDs that they like. I do not believe that's the case. So what I would say, although I like the supermajority idea, it really should be to have a supermajority to deny a string rather than to affirm it. I do not believe that the board's role here is to pick and choose different TLDs. Thank you.
Thanks, Anthony. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but is the concept of supermajority of the board being thrown out there as just applying to morality and public order objections, strings, not generally. Is that correct?
That's certainly my idea, and the reason that it would be so is simply because the process that was in place has foundered on the objections of the Government Advisory Committee, which doesn't like how it's formulated, and obviously we are dealing with a subjective issue here, and so it's not really very amenable to objective standards, in which case it pretty much needs to be overwhelming that there is a problem with a particular string before it can be denied. So I would say, yes, this is only for this particular kind of objection.
Right. Okay, thank you. Now, both Bertrand and Anthony have raised a very fundamental question, and I briefly see that some discussion is going on the chat as well. And either now or sometime in the very near future, I think it's fairly critical to our discussion in this group to get an answer to the question. And I'll rephrase the question this way. Does the board, assuming a new GTLD application goes through the entire process and everything's passed and approved and ready for delegation, is an action of the board required for that name to go into the root?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay. Thanks, Kurt. I appreciate that. And so, and I thought that was important based on what your assumption was, Anthony, to make sure that we're all on the same page there. I'm not advocating one way or another, but that was my understanding, as Kurt stated.
Can I ask a follow-up to that, Kurt?
You're breaking up a little bit. Say that again, please, Anthony.
May I ask a follow-up question?
Oh, yes, you may.
So, Kurt, as I understand it, the whole process is to evaluate and qualify the different applications. So does the board have absolute discretion on what they can say yes or no to?
Well, this is Kurt. So first, I didn't say I think so. And I think the person that I said I think so doesn't sound like me.
Okay.
So I think, you know, the board has yet to define its role in the new GTLD process. You know, certainly one form of board role would be to look at the evaluation that's taken place, verify that it was according to the published process, and therefore approve the results of the process. So, for example, each board meeting, it could take the applications that are accepted and rejected during that time period and affirm those results, or it could just take the ones that are approved and direct those to be delegated. Or the board might cut out for itself a more active role. So certainly the board has discretion to do what it wants in these matters, and I think the first step will be for the board to make clear what its role is going to be in approving these delegations. Right now, as you probably know, it considers very carefully applications for requests for delegation or redelegation that primarily take place in CCTLD. And certainly a new type of process is required for the board to be able to consider the higher volume of delegation requests that are going to occur with the new GTLD process. So does the board have discretion? Sure it does. But the discussion I've seen on the among the board indicates that it recognizes that, you know, some sort of process that enables it to handle the volume of requests is going to be required.
Thanks, Kirk. Appreciate that. And so it sounds to me like, I mean, there certainly would be good timing if this particular group came forward with some recommendations, like some of the things being tossed out. Going on, and we're running out of time. We've only got about 7 or 8 minutes, so I'd like to get to the other people in the queue, and I think, Frank, you're next.
Thank you. Thank you, Chuck. I just wanted to return to the issue of outsourcing, because I don't know if that was completely put to bed. And just a comment, not from a GAC point of view, but from a New Zealand perspective, perhaps. It is perfectly acceptable, in my view, for the board to seek expert advice externally. I don't think that should in any way be confused with outsourcing, because the board, in the end, has all... And I think Kurt has covered this admirably, actually, that the board, in the end, has total discretion over its actions, but it always has legal liability for its actions. It cannot escape that, and it shouldn't try to... it cannot contract out of that. So the question of outsourcing, I think it's a complete red herring. But that's all I wanted to say.
Thanks, Frank. Constantino.
Yes, Chuck. I'm not sure whether we moved from the International Chamber of Commerce discussion, but I would just like to actually agree with what Milton said. And I'm really right now looking at the website, and actually it says that the International Center for Expertise, exactly the same way it's phrased in Appendix A, is there to has built up unique access to experts in every conceivable subject relevant to business operations. So it appears that it is linked to commercial interest, and I would really like to express my concern about such a center, no matter the access that they have to panelists dealing with disputes on morality and public order. International law has many faces. They may have international law experts in economic law or any other business-related or commercial issue, but I am not sure whether they are the ones, the appropriate forum to deal with MAPO disputes, and I would like to ask Eiken staff to provide more information as to the choice of that center. Thank you.
Okay, and well, Eiken staff, well, I'm not going to give them time right now because I want to get the people in the queue, but that would be helpful information, and I would also challenge those of you who aren't crazy about the ICC unit there to certainly provide recommendations with regard to alternatives for that body. Let's go on to Milton.
Yeah, just to quickly follow up, the alternative that I've been advocating to the ICC is a board decision. That is, and this would only apply, Chuck, in response to your very good question about other kinds of objections. In my mind, with morality and public order, we were dealing with a new form of global content regulation, and that's a very fateful and very important kind of global regulation that is different from the other kinds of objections, which are less significant in their free expression and human rights concerns. So what the alternative is what I'd like to see, and I think this is a reasonable middle ground because it's not my ideal situation in which a lot of these concerns simply wouldn't happen. But if you are going to raise issues about sensitivities and content regulation and censorship of top-level domains, I want the board to be the direct and ultimate final arbiter of those, and I want the board to have to veto a TLD only with a very high supermajority, something on the order of 75%. In that case, number one, you're satisfying this criteria, which we seem to forget about, the objectivity and predictability of the process. You cannot say, oh, you know, we can go through this long, incredibly expensive process of meeting all these criteria and satisfying all these objections, and then at the end of the day, the board can just do whatever the heck it wants. As one of the commenters on the bulletin board said, we've been moving away from that process because of the disasters that it's caused so far. And we want the process to be predictable, and indeed that's part of the policy. That's hardwired into the policy. So I would like to see people who want to raise these kinds of content-based objections to raise those objections and then see if they can get 75% of the board to support them. If the string or whatever is associated with it is so repugnant that, you know, the supermajority of the board agrees that it just shouldn't exist, then even though, again, I don't like that kind of censorship, I don't think it should exist, I could accept that as a reasonable compromise.
Okay, thank you. Now, we're very close to out of time. I'm going to jump the queue a little bit because and let one person who hasn't spoken yet speak, and then I'll come back to Miriam Bertrand, and then we're going to have to call it quits there, so I'll ask each of you to be brief. Richard Tindall, would you please join the queue?
Yeah, thanks, Chuck. I just wanted to make a simple observation about process. I'm wondering if it's possible for us to have two calls per week instead of one.
That's a good suggestion. Anybody opposed to exploring that? And we may want to adjust, make the times different so that it's not late or early for the same people. Glenn, Thursdays, I think, are typically bad days because of lots of things going on. Yes. Was that Glenn?
Sorry, I was on mute. Would you please repeat your question?
Yeah, the suggestion was made that we may want to consider two calls a week. Could we do a doodle and let's try and pick a different time. If we do a second day of the week, let's try and pick a different time of the day so that the same people aren't always really late or really early, if that's possible. Could
I'll
you
do
maybe
that.
Maybe on Wednesdays and Thursdays? I know Thursdays are kind of bad days usually, but if you could do that, I'd appreciate it. Thanks,
I'll
Richard,
do that, Chuck.
For that. And so let's go. Frank, did you still have your hand up?
Apologies, it's coming down.
Okay, that's all right. Mary.
Hi, just a very quick follow-up to finish off the point. I think this question of the board's responsibility and whether any panel decision is binding is really important, because the way I read what's currently in version 4, it either sounds like a duck or pretty binding. It says the findings of the panel will be considered an expert determination and advice that ICANN will accept within the dispute resolution process. That troubles me. And the other thing that troubles me and that I think will require this the board's responsibility to be resolved is that if you're talking about international law, leaving aside morality issues, we're talking about private corporation and private applicants, and yet we're talking also about international law where the proper forums, international courts and so forth, where nation states appear, there just isn't any existing mechanism that can take care of it. And maybe we haven't talked about this, but this is a truth we have to recognize. If we're designing a process, we're designing a brand new process that doesn't recognize, that doesn't exist within the public international law regime. Thank you.
Thank you, Mary. Bertrand.
Yeah, very quickly, I support the distinction that Frank was using between expert advice and outsourcing and the whole notion of whether the panel is binding or not. The ultimate decision-making role of the board. And I wanted to just highlight the following points. One of the key elements that we're trying to address here is the situation where a string is not completely unacceptable for everybody, but raises very strong sensitivities and even high national concerns in some countries that would lead that country to block it. Therefore, the question we're facing is there are two extreme options. One is to say anything should go in the root, and it is just up for governments to block, which means that we will have many situations where there would be blocking, and we haven't discussed the notion of universal resolvability, which is an important notion for the GAC, and I can deal with that in more detail later on, because it is not an absolute principle, it's an objective.
And the other extreme, which would, as I said earlier, be the solution where there would be a de facto veto right for every single GAC member, for instance, as soon as they don't like one string. None of those two extremes, in my view, are acceptable. And so the key challenge that we have is to find a process that can handle the cases where, even when there is an objection in a certain number of countries, maybe the string will get in the root nonetheless, and the country will block it, and other cases where the objections are sufficiently widespread for the board ultimately to make a decision, with a supermajority or not, to say, well, all well considered, we think that the cons outweigh the pros and it shouldn't get in. So it's about exploring this intermediary zone, and I fully agree with Ivan, and we can discuss that further. There is no universal resolvability today, and there clearly will not be a universal resolvability when there are many TLDs. However, we could still have an approach that says basically there is a general objective to try to achieve as much universal resolvability as we can, and the blocking of a top-level domain can only be done under specific legal processes at the national level for instance, morality and public order rules. This is why there's a distinction between using morality and public order at the national level to take a legal decision to block a specific TLD and using the criteria of morality and public order as a general norm to prevent a TLD altogether to get in the root. Morality and public order is and should always be exceptions.
Thank you, Bertrand, and I just in closing would suggest maybe a different term instead of universal resolvability is maybe the goal might be to maximize resolvability, because we probably never get universal, but anyway, I'll just throw that out for thought. And I want to thank everybody for excellent contributions, and I think we got a lot of thoughts on the table. Keep thinking about ways that we can develop some recommendations that maybe most of us could support and put forward. In the meantime, Glenn's going to come out with a doodle to try and find another time during the week when we could meet. And I don't know that we're going to be able to do that this week or not. But the first meeting next week, at least, will be devoted to, and Amy, if you can arrange for the expert to be on the call next week. And for right now, let's assume that this same time will be on Monday of next week. Now, I know that's a holiday in the United States. I also know that I may not have good connectivity that day, but Cheryl, hopefully you will, and in case I can't call in, you can pick up for me.
And Chuck, this is Amy.
Yes, Amy.
Yes, I mean, I have sent an email. I had not talked to anybody in advance of me making that offer, so we will do our absolute best to get somebody online next Monday. I just can't guarantee it.
Yeah, just do the best you can, and if it can't be then, that doesn't mean it has to be then. We can do it the second meeting next week or whatever works, but I understand the limitations. Thank you. Okay, thank you, everybody. Have a good rest of the day. Good evening.
Thank you.
Kelly?
Chuck, are you still on the line?